Our ancestors sailed across oceans in leaky wooden boats and conquered continents. They fed the hungry and healed the sick. They measured the width of the universe and the weight of the atom. They survived 40,000 years of plague, famine, invasions. We will survive nihilism and despair because we are their children. We are Europa's children. Hello, I'm Kenaz Filan, and the existence of our people is not negotiable. Hello, I'm Kenaz Filan. Welcome to our second episode of Europa's Children, the podcast. Tonight we're talking about something that's, I don't know if it's near and dear to my heart, but I did visit the city a couple times. Had a wonderful time with my wife Kathy at the PantheaCon conference about 15 years ago. San Francisco. San Francisco is an absolutely magical place. 60 years ago, it was ground zero for the hippie movement and flower power, the Grateful Dead, Ken Kesey. So much has come out of there. Today, it's ground zero for the tech industry. It's one of the world's leading tech centers. There's just this great feeling of possibility. And about it all, you've got the trolley cars, those lovely Victorian homes, and all the pretty people flying their freak flags. It's this fairy sense of timelessness. It's this place where nothing's forbidden, everything is permissible, and the skies are always clear, and the breezes smelled of perfume gardens and oceans. Well, San Francisco doesn't smell like that anymore. In 2011, the San Francisco Department of Public Works logged just over 5,500 incidents of human feces found on public streets. Okay, 5,500 incidents of human feces on your streets. I'm sure if anybody here has been to San Francisco, it's rather a small and a compact city. There's not a lot of San Francisco to San Francisco, and 5,500 piles of human shit on the street. That's a lot of shit. So I'm sure you figure they must have done something about that to clean it up, given that this is also a huge tourist center, but, well, not exactly. By 2018, the number of reported incidents of human feces in the San Francisco streets had increased to more than 28,000. February of 2018, an NBC Bay Area news investigation surveys 153 blocks of downtown San Francisco in search of trash, needles, and feces. First thing they discovered in their investigation is there was trash in 153 of 153 blocks. 41 of the blocks were also dotted with used syringes, and 96 were home to one or more piles of street person droppings. Now, the big response to why is there so much shit in the streets of San Francisco is, well, it's a homeless crisis caused by the high price of housing and rents. And there's definitely something to that. San Francisco is a very, very expensive place to live. The median price on a one-bedroom apartment is close to $4,000 now, if not a little bit over. You're going to spend over $1 million to get a condo. Yeah, it's a very, very expensive place to live, but there's more to it than that. I'm speaking as somebody who's been homeless and mentally ill. I could say, most of the people listening here, should you find yourself on the streets, should you find your family on the streets, one of the first priorities you're going to have, one of the first things you're going to look for is a place to stay clean and a place to use the bathroom. You're not going to go drop a deuce in front of City Hall. You're going to want to use a bathroom. And yes, finding a public bathroom can be very difficult, especially in San Francisco. But if you couldn't find those bathrooms, if you couldn't find those places to stay clean, you'd go to another city where you could. The people who are staying here in San Francisco, who are shitting in the streets, are doing so not because they can't afford to pay rent. They're doing so because they're floridly mentally ill, because they're so ill with addiction, with schizophrenia, with whatever brought them to these streets. You know, they have so lost control of their lives, so lost control of themselves, that they're defecating in public. I mean, let's just stop and think about that for a second. You know, these people are really ill. And instead of treating those illnesses, you know, never mind the healthcare crisis caused by streets full of shit, you know, instead of treating those mental illnesses, San Francisco's chosen to show tolerance to the homeless and the mentally ill and to respect their diverse lifestyles by largely looking the other way while they exist in these squalid, horrible camps where we're facing medieval diseases and you're letting them fester like that. People who are incapable of taking care of themselves, you're leaving them fester in the name of protecting their freedom. In 2018, Leilani Farha, UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, said that the squalor in San Francisco violated UN human rights law and commented, "The last time I saw cooking on a sidewalk was when I was in Mumbai." The problem is, things may be worse in San Francisco than they are in cities and countries where there's a history of people defecating outdoors. So a notorious 4chan joke wherein an Indian poster tried to defend India's public defecation problem by pointing out that in India, most cities have designated shitting streets. And now that all sounds very funny, but there, in those places, there is a tradition of using alleys, using latrines, using back roads, using designated shitting streets. Because we are pack animals and we instinctively know that having to waste too close to your food supply or too close to your living area is a bad thing and causes diseases. You know, that's hardwired into us. When you've got to sit, what you have in San Francisco is something a lot worse than that. You know, you've got people who are no longer capable of recognizing those needs or who have been forced into conditions, are living in conditions where those needs cannot be met. That's a health crisis. That is a humanitarian crisis. You cannot dismiss the problem here as systematic racism. You cannot blame white people for forcing floridly ill, mentally ill people to drop a deuce on City Hall steps. There's a bigger problem going on here, and it's something I talked about in a Pendulum article. In 1950, there were over 500,000 Americans confined in state mental hospitals. Psychiatrists at that time did not really have a lot of options. Two of the biggest scientific advances that had only happened a couple decades ago were electroconvulsive therapy, otherwise known as shock therapy. They discovered you could get some patients out of really deep depressions or bad psychotic states by knocking them unconscious with an insulin coma, or in a safer version, just zapping some electrical volts through their brain. And speaking of brains, there was also the lobotomy. That was fast and effective. You could take an ice pick, scrape it on the frontal lobe, and most of the patients became considerably more docile and tractable. Barring that, there were the other time-honored methods like cold baths, restraints, straitjackets, truncheons, solitary confinement. Yeah, it was not an ideal healthcare situation. There were definitely abuses. There were people who were confined in those hospitals who did not belong in those hospitals. Conditions in those hospitals were frequently horrible. But the people confined there were fed, clothed, and housed. We can't argue about whether they were adequately provided with any of those things, certainly, but they were fed and clothed and housed. In 1963, Ken Kesey, who had briefly been employed at a mental hospital in Oregon, released a book entitled One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The book and a subsequent movie reshaped the way Americans viewed state mental institutions and the psychiatric industry in general. By 1963, that same year, President Kennedy signed legislation which funded community-based mental health facilities. We really wanted to move away from those institutions, which, you know, as I acknowledged, were pretty horrible places, and more towards mainstreaming ill people into the community, helping them become, you know, part of society rather than shutting them away in these institutions. And that's a lovely idea. Unfortunately, the further funding for these community centers never really materialized. And the community centers that came in, which were about half of what President Kennedy had envisioned originally, got flooded by this tidal wave of deinstitutionalized people. And yet there were people who were deinstitutionalized who could be mainstreamed into society, but there were so many more who lacked the capability to function outside of a structured environment, who were incapable of keeping to a schedule of medication, of making regular appointments for therapy. These were people who needed to be in a structured environment, and they were deinstitutionalized into the streets, and of course it ended badly. Much has been written about the rise of the American prison industrial complex and about the enormous percentage of Americans who are incarcerated. And you know, there's a great deal to be said about that. This is an enormous problem. But one thing that often gets neglected is nobody really compares the rise in American incarceration rates into prisons with the rate of the deinstitutionalization of American patients from state mental hospitals. Prisons used to be for people who were criminals. We had treatment hospitals for addicts. We had hospitals for the criminally insane, for those who had serious emotional issues. Today, prisons have become a dumping ground for the Americans who are too mentally ill to function in our society. In our prisons, these mentally ill inmates have less access to medical and mental health care than they would have had in a state institution. They are even more at risk of violence, not only from guards, but from their fellow inmates who often prey upon them. And in some ways, they may be the lucky ones. Those mentally ill who were deinstitutionalized, who are well enough to avoid committing crimes that would get them incarcerated, wind up living on the streets. Instead of sleeping on an institution bed, they sleep in a steam grate. Instead of eating at a cafeteria, they eat out of garbage cans or at soup kitchens. And this is seen as a great humanitarian improvement in mental health care. So how should we deal with this crisis? And again, it is a medical and a mental health crisis. There are an estimated 7,500 homeless people in San Francisco right now. What if we declared a medical emergency, we rounded up these 7,500 people and rehomed them in temporary refugee camps, as we would for people who are living in these squalid conditions in a war-torn country? There, we could provide them with mental health care, we could provide medical care, we could give them assistance in getting off drugs. You know, we could do something for them, and we could abate a medical crisis, a medical emergency, because we are seeing typhus, we're seeing cholera. We could do something that would be a net positive for everybody involved, including the homeless people. But we won't, because we're so frightened that we might interfere with their freedom of choice and their personal rights. Look, I understand the dangers attendant upon saying that somebody is not of sound mind and is incapable of caring for himself or caring for herself. I understand how badly that power can be abused, but I think we can safely say that a person who's dropping a coiler in the middle of the sidewalk is incapable of caring for himself, caring for herself, and needs to be in a place where somebody can look at, where they can be looked after. Look, freedom is a wonderful thing, but But when you give freedom of choice to people who are incapable of making informed choices, that's not stunning and brave. It's cruel. This is Kenaz Filan. You have been listening to Europa's Children. Thank you for listening. And remember, the existence of our people is not negotiable.